I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, an emotional debate on the floor of the state house last night proves that the Democratic Party in Washington state is fundamentally broken.
We've got to speak for the children, the ones who can't speak for themselves.
What we are saying is that DCYF must prove that there is abuse or neglect, not just that there is fentanyl around.
Also, Brian Haywood joins us to reflect on the initiatives that had hearings this week. Plus, no punishment for the school superintendent who stole opponents' political yard signs. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Washington State's Democratic Party is broken. It is broken, and I've believed that for a long time, but I don't think there's been anything that has illustrated why I have been so hard on Democratic state lawmakers as a debate on the floor of the state house last night. A debate where one side was trying to protect kids from death, and the other side was making excuses for drug addicts. That is the entirety of that debate in a nutshell. I'm going to go through some of the comments from lawmakers on both sides about this particular bill in a moment. I will tell you up front that it's going to be long. This is going to be a long conversation. It'll probably take up the first half hour of our show today. But I think it is critical in understanding how ideology is driving the Washington State Democratic Party in a way that it is simply not driving the Republican Party in Washington, and how ideology gets in the way of good policy, and how ideology is getting in the way of saving the most vulnerable people in our population, and those are kids who cannot protect themselves. So I hope that you come away from this segment. You can tell I'm a little upset. I'm a little upset. I'm like, I told Nicole before we started, I'm kind of shaking because I had heard, Nicole and I both got a lot of texts last night about this hearing as it was, this debate as it was happening, and we got a chance this morning to go back and watch it, and it is infuriating. So this centers around Senate Bill 6109. We've talked about it a bit on the show, this issue of protecting kids from drug abuse in homes. You might recall that State Representative Travis Couture, a Republican, had a stronger version of this bill, and Democrats basically took his bill, watered it down, came up with Senate Bill 6109, and what it would do is try to fix some of the problems with the Keeping Families Together Act that was passed a couple years ago in Olympia. And what that did, that act did, is basically make it hard to remove a kid from a home where there's active drug abuse. And it said that that in and of itself is not imminent harm to a child. And since then, more children have died as a result of being exposed to drugs in their home. So there's something that is fundamentally wrong with the Keeping Families Together Act. And there was at least some bipartisan recognition this session that, hey, we need to do something to fix that. Maybe having a drug as deadly as fentanyl around a small child should be, I don't know, cause to remove that child from the home temporarily while the parent gets their act together. So the watered-down version that Democrats put forth in Senate Bill 6109 would essentially say that in the case of synthetic opioids only, so fentanyl, that a judge can use great weight in deciding whether that is enough to remove a child from the home. It is not imminent harm. If you had a law like Travis Couture wanted that said, yeah, that's imminent harm if you're using fentanyl around a child, then a judge would say, yeah, that's imminent harm. We're taking that child out, at least for now. Great weight is a squishy term that is going to continue to give judges a lot of discretion in deciding whether it's okay for a parent to use fentanyl around a kid. As Representative Travis Couture pointed out, so this watered-down version comes up for a vote last night on the floor of the House. And Representative Couture gave it one last shot to try to strengthen the bill, to say, hey, great weight, it is not enough. It has to be imminent harm or even something in between. Here's what he had to say.
Great weight is barely a legal term. Great weight is essentially asking the judge to think about it really hard
when these situations come up to the court, if we should remove a child where there is fentanyl in the home. What this amendment will do is strike great weight and add a real standard of law, rebuttable presumption, which is constitutional. And let me explain to you what rebuttable presumption means and what it does. It presumes that we should remove the child from a home where there is fentanyl present, that is, by the numbers I'm going to tell you soon, very highly likely to kill the child, especially if they're an infant or a toddler. And it allows the parent to rebut that presumption in court. And there are many other instances in our state law where rebuttable presumption is the case, and also in family law as well. If we decide that great weight is the best standard to protect kids in our state from fentanyl, what will happen is that there will be a patchwork of different decisions across jurisdictions and courts all across our state, because it will be left up to each individual judge to decide how much weight they want to put behind it. We need to have rebuttable presumption so that we can have the max protection for kids, Mr. Speaker, and I urge you to vote yes on this amendment because we need it more than anything. Thank you.
The max protection for kids. Here's how Democratic State Representative Jamila Taylor responded to this amendment from Representative Couture, her argument why the threshold for removing kids from a home where fentanyl is being abused should not be lowered.
I urge you to vote no against this amendment. Parents have a fundamental right to parent their children. And when the state is involved in taking children from them, they have the obligation to prove their case, prove that the family must be separated. And putting the burden on the parents to prove a negative is not going to actually help these children. Mr. Speaker, we have to believe in a system that you're innocent until proven guilty. Rebuttable presumption in this context is requiring us to turn our procedural due process on its head in order to make the parent establish all the things that are going correctly and not actually get the help that they need in other circumstances, or not be able to have information that is accessible to them in this hearing without legal counsel.
Yeah. So, all of a sudden Democrats, they believe in parental rights. And even if there's fentanyl in the home, I mean, we can't, innocent until proven guilty. Just the act of using fentanyl around a child, that's not enough to remove a child from the home. Representative Chris Corey, a Republican who also is a foster parent, rebutted that and basically said, look, you know, leaving kids in these circumstances presents an imminent danger that that child could die.
My wife and I got a call around April 1st, April 2nd, 2017. We were licensed foster parents, and we were asked if we would take a placement of a newborn. We said, absolutely, we would love to. When will this child be coming to our home? It's going to be a few days. Okay, why is it going to be a few days? Well, the baby is currently detoxing in the hospital. The next question my wife asked was, well, who is with that child right now? We were informed the parent had left and that the baby was in a crib and hospital staff were going to help them if they could. My wife looked at me and said, you've got the kids, I'm going to the hospital. We spent the next 5 days taking turns holding a little child going through withdrawal. I don't know if you've ever had that experience, but it is one of the most heartbreaking and crushing things you will ever go through in your life, Mr. Speaker. I agree that parents have a right to parent their kids, but the state has a right to protect the children of this state from abuse and neglect. And putting fentanyl or any other kind of drugs in, around, near, or on a child is unconscionable. This amendment is essential to pass this bill. Please join me in voting yes for the thousands of kids around this state that cannot wait for protection.
Here is the response to that from Democratic State Representative Tonneson.
What we are saying is that DCYF must prove that there is abuse or neglect. Not just that there was fentanyl around, exposed to them, nearby. We are saying that if they suspect abuse or neglect, and there's fentanyl, then absolutely, let's make sure that we understand that fentanyl is super lethal. Let me give you an example, a real-life example of why we do not just want rebuttable presumption out of the gate without DCYF having to prove their case. There's a tragedy, Mr. Speaker, in your community where a family lost their young son. It was a loving family, and sadly, the young son got access to some marijuana that was laced with fentanyl. And this young boy died. This family is devastated. They are reeling from this. With this rebuttable presumption, that family would have all of their children taken away immediately, dragged into court, no abuse, no neglect, loving family, sad overdose. They need to prove that there was abuse or neglect. That is what CPS is all about. That is what they do. That is their job.
They need to prove abuse or neglect. Again, it is the contention of Democrats that the simple act of using one of the most deadly drugs that exists around a child, no matter how young that child is not enough proof of abuse and neglect. That is Democrats taking the side of drug addicts over an extreme ideology, over the side of, out of an abundance of caution, making sure that children don't die. I also wanted to play for you remarks from State Representative Leonard Christian, a Republican, who talked about some of his personal experiences as a child and why he was supportive of the amendment to strengthen this bill.
Mr. Speaker, I was not going to talk about this, to be honest with you, because it hurts. It hurts to bring my story up, but I'm gonna, because maybe it can just change a few minds in here. Maybe it'll change your mind, Mr. Speaker. Now, I'm pretty much for family rights. I believe in the Constitution, and I do. But Mr. Speaker, growing up, my mother continually left us alone. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I was about 10 years old when I smelled marijuana for the first time. It was when my brother and his friends were smoking in the house marijuana. My little sister was there. We went out for a walk because I needed to protect her. Mr. Speaker, my mom couldn't sit still. About every 6 to 8 months, we would move. She'd pick up the whole family and off we'd go. As we got a little older, she decided that my brother turned 12. He was old enough to be in charge. As she went cross-country trucking, she gave him money to buy food for us, which he bought drugs with, to share with his friends. After the neighbors would finally catch on, or the school teachers would realize the only meal we were getting is at school. So the police would come, pick us up, and take us to foster care. But my mom was presumed to be a good parent. So we were given back, and off to the next town we went, where she did it again, and did it again, and again, and again. Mr. Speaker, there's days when you can't presume there's good parents, and when these kids are dying of fentanyl, we've got to step in. We've got to speak for the children, the ones who can't speak for themselves. Don't make them grow up like I did. Please vote yes for this amendment.
So who ultimately spoke for the children? Here's the vote on Travis Couture's amendment to, again, lower the threshold to remove a child from a home where fentanyl is actively being abused around them.
The speaker's about to start the roll call machine. The speaker has started the roll call machine.
Mr. Speaker, there are 46 yeas, 49 nays, 3 excused.
The amendment is not adopted.
Now, the underlying bill did go on to pass, and I think that that's a good thing. I think it at least fixes some of the errors of the Keeping Families Together Act, but we don't really know how judges are going to interpret this bill. Great weight about fentanyl abuse. I guess time will tell. But what I want to point out is I think reasonable people can disagree on this topic. You know, certainly there are some conservatives who have been fighting for parental rights and who might believe that, hey, if we make it easier for the government to take away our kids, then they're just going to continue to erode our parental rights. And so I can see some reasonable disagreements on this particular topic. But what struck me in hearing the testimony from Democrats is how 180 it was from their testimony this time last year on Senate Bill 5599. If you recall, Senate Bill 5599 essentially said that kids could run away from home and seek shelter under the protection of the state of Washington if their parents didn't agree with, for instance, their gender identity. If you had a kid who wanted to get gender hormone therapy, for instance, and their parents weren't supportive of that, that they could run away from home and be hidden, protected at a shelter under the protection of the state of Washington and the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, and that there was no burden for the state to prove that the parent was a danger to their child or the parent was abusive, just that the parent didn't support their child's desired gender or sexual identity. So what I want to do in making this point, because I think it shows the utter moral hypocrisy, the lack of clarity and consistency in the priorities of the Democratic Party, I want to revisit a couple of these clips and I want to compare the two debates. And I want you to really think long and hard about what it says about the state of the Washington Democratic Party. So this is, again, Democratic State Representative Tana Sen during last night's debate, arguing that we can't just take a child out of a home where there's drug abuse without ample proof.
What we are saying is that DCYF must prove that there is abuse or neglect. Not just that there is fentanyl around or exposed to them nearby.
So here's that same state representative, Tana Sen, 1 year ago today, arguing in support of Senate Bill 5599.
People do die from a lack of love and support. And in fact, 52% of LGBTQ youth have considered committing suicide. So whether this is about negligence and abuse, we know that affirmation is critical, and this bill is about saving lives. We have an obligation, whether they're 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, or 18, to help them, to prevent them from becoming victims, and to give them the supports and the shelter that they need. So we're not taking away parental rights. We are giving care to our vulnerable youth.
Wow. Wow. So 5599 was about saving lives of children. 5599 wasn't about taking away parental rights. It was about making sure that these kids are safe and cared for. So when you're debating this year a bill that literally is life or death for kids, oh, we can't take children out of the home simply because of drug abuse without ample proof, without the state having ample proof. 1 year ago, we can hide kids from their parents as a state of Washington if those parents might not support their gender identity. No proof needed. That's a lack of moral clarity. I'll give you another example. Representative Jamila Taylor, again, last night, arguing against protecting kids from parents who are actively abusing drugs around them.
Parents have a fundamental right to parent their children. And when the state is involved in taking children from them, they have the obligation to prove their case, prove that the family must be separated. We have to believe in a system that you're innocent until proven guilty.
So if it's drug abuse in the home, the state has an obligation to prove their case, an obligation to prove that there's imminent risk to that child. That's her argument last night. 1 year ago, in arguing in favor of Senate Bill 5599, state doesn't have to prove anything, just that you might not support your child's gender identity according to the kid.
It's the combination, the tone, the tenor, the threats, the isolation, the words that are constantly told, you cannot be uniquely you. You cannot be something other than what I desire for you to be. And if you do not follow my rules, you cannot be here. When I see a young person come to me on a regular basis saying, I can't go home, home is not safe, am I not going to do something? Are we not going to do something? We must step in. We must provide a place for this child.
We must step in. We must provide a place for this child. Are we not going to do something? When you have an LGBTQ youth whose parents don't agree with them wanting to get gender hormones, we have to step in. We have an obligation to step in, she said a year ago. And then this year she's arguing for parental rights, even when that parent is using drugs around their child. Let that sink in. And she even went as far as to say, by the way, when she was testifying or she was speaking on behalf of 5599 last year, that the state was much better off hiding a child from their parents just in case. That, oh, we're not taking the child forever. We're going to hide them temporarily because wouldn't you rather us hide your child than your child die? Here's what she said.
I know you don't want the call because your child is admitted into the hospital because they were beaten to their bones because of a hate crime. I know you don't want the call because your child is so desperate. It's in so much despair that they took their own life. I don't want you to have that call. Madam Speaker, I want you to have that call from DCYF, not the coroner.
So better the state protect those kids now than those kids dying. But when we're talking about a very real scenario right now where kids are dying, being left in a bush in their car seat by their drug-addicted father, when we have real, tangible examples right now of kids dying in the home because they're exposed to deadly drugs, Democrats want to argue that the state needs a higher burden of proof to protect that child in the moment, a higher burden of proof than they wanted 1 year ago to argue that the state should be able to hide kids from parents who didn't abuse them, who didn't use drugs around them, but who might not want them to get gender hormone therapy. The Democratic Party in our state's fundamentally broken. Those are depths of hypocrisy that you cannot recover from. I want to be on the side that's protecting kids from bad parents, and that's making sure that kids aren't being hidden from good parents. That's the side that I'm going to be on. And I would highly suggest that the Washington State Democratic Party, after the session is over on Friday, really take some time to be introspective between now and the next session about what they really stand for, what they want to accomplish, whether protecting kids is actually important to them, whether parental rights are actually important to them. Because right now it's really hard to understand where they stand on anything. Because the hypocrisy is at levels that no one should be willing to accept. All right. Coming up next, I want to get to our friend Brian Haywood. We had hearings this week on three critical initiatives that we believe lawmakers are going to pass, maybe as early as Monday, potentially. Brian Haywood, of course, is with Let's Go Washington, and he has put up a lot of money to make these six initiatives possible. And so he has a lot of skin in the game, so to speak. There are going to be three initiatives that are going to go to voters in November, but we asked him to come in and just reflect on what happened in the hearings this week. Brian Haywood, welcome back to Undivided.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
An exciting week, I think.
It's been very eventful.
Yeah, you got a chance to go down and to testify. Of the three hearings, is there one that you think went the best?
The one I testified at, I'm going to say, is the one that went the best okay. in a way. But in a way, what I got to do is go down to the sausage factory and sort of watch how the sausage gets made, yeah. which one shouldn't do. But it was very fascinating to watch the theatrics, because there was some attempt at saying, hey, we're going to look at these. And then there was a much broader attempt at theatrics.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the theatrics. So you know, whenever you come testify, you risk being asked questions, and you better damn well be prepared to answer their questions. And you had a retort, gosh, I'm can't remember which lawmaker it was, you'll know, who said, well, have you thought about the people who are killed in police pursuits and all of this?
I'm just curious, you know, you talked about folks that are impacted or victimized by this and the consultation that went into this initiative. But I'm wondering, you know, for the families of folks who have been paralyzed and injured as bystanders, which I know of at least four situations where there were nonviolent offenses and the result was devastating to the families. I'm just curious, were any of those voices incorporated in the consultation of this initiative? And what was the result of that?
I have not spoken to anyone that experienced that, and I express deep concern and condolences for families that have lost life. We don't support that, and as the gentleman suggested, the ideal is not to have to chase criminals to begin with, but when we've loosened our laws so much that criminals feel emboldened and empowered to act without concern for what the police will do, I believe that we'll have much more loss of life, loss of mobility, and much greater crime by not making it clear that certain activities are not acceptable within society. And we haven't done that with this law.
The lucky thing, I think, on our side, and I hate to use the word lucky, it's a horrible question and it's a horrible situation. And when bad things happen, you know, it's tragic for the family. And I don't, so that's sort of the quick answer. But I guess the fortunate thing in a way for me is that I've been out there now talking about these for more than 6 months. And it's not the first time someone's asked me, what about this or what about that? Whereas I think for them, some of them, they're kind of coming up with their questions right now, and maybe I've got a gotcha. And so it's one that you could imagine is going to be there, right? There was the tragic situation in Seattle where some police hit a pedestrian, and it's nothing, there's nothing you can say, but it's really tragic. But then there's this bigger discussion, which you don't have time to do in a hearing, of course, of the weight of a policy overall.
Yes.
And if your idea is that, you know, if we can even just save one person, it's worth it. Well, the problem with that is then there's Amber Goldade, whose daughter was murdered by someone who should have been in prison. So you have to look at the overall totality of the impact. And I think it's loss of life is a horrific thing, and we need to minimize that. And there's tragedies left behind. But our whole society has been devastated by this stupid policy.
Yeah. And it's the right way to look at it. And I wish we could kind of take the political blinders off, because there's a lot of Democrats who want to solely focus on people who are injured or killed as a result of police pursuits and then ignore all these clear other public safety issues, deaths that are because police pursuits never occurred. Right. And so I thought that your retort was really good in just saying, yeah, that's horrible. Of course that's horrible. We don't want loss of life, but we do have to unfortunately weigh the totality of the situation. There were some complaints about the police pursuit hearing in particular that it seemed like Democrats weren't super eager to spend a lot of time hearing from people in the room. Did you feel that way?
Absolutely. They had two professors from out of state.
New York, right? One of them.
Yeah. So they had one which was like, I'll say, boy, the kind of South Carolina professor who was talked so long that even Manga Dinger was like, oh, well, easy now. Let's okay, you filibustered long enough. Yeah. We need to move on to our next filibuster. And then sort of the simpering New York guy who, and I sort of felt almost like it was it's better to be lucky than smart, or better to be lucky than good. And in both cases, they put people up there that if you weren't asleep beforehand, you were asleep. Like, well, what are they even saying? And then get to the point, and they didn't really say anything meaningful.
Yeah, there is something really disconnected about having a room full of your constituents and Washingtonians who are ready to testify, and you call in as a professor from New York on Zoom.
And then give him an unlimited amount of time.
Wild stuff.
And there were several police officers there who had traveled from all over the state to come and give what I think would have been very relevant testimony. And if you're going to put these restrictions on the police, you certainly, there's two people in particular you should listen to. One is people that have been affected by it, either for or against, but also the police officers who are in the line of duty. And one of the points I tried to make, I think that I think that one of the more dangerous aspects of the police pursuit law as it stands now is what I mentioned in my testimony. If you're a law-abiding citizen and you find out that a guy crashed his car into a storefront, stole a bunch of stuff, then drove off in front of the police and the police didn't pursue him, and then you get pulled over for doing 67 mm-hmm. on the freeway, in your mind you're going, man, that's not fair. That makes me mad. And I think it creates a disrespect for the law, and perhaps more dangerously, a disrespect for the police.
Yeah.
One of the officers I heard talk about after the fact, because they didn't get interviewed, was talking about how criminals now just, they'll walk by and just flip them off and then speed off. And they're just mocking the police.
Yeah, that was Sheriff Derek Sanders, who showed up to testify and wasn't called upon while they let the guy from New York come in. The other two hearings, it was interesting because Democrats had a similar narrative in those two hearings, both for the no income tax and for the parental rights. And that narrative was, we don't even need these.
Right.
We don't even need these. You have a no income tax in the Constitution, right. And 90% of what's in the parental rights things, we already do. So that is going to be their narrative moving forward. But I guess my retort, and I'm sure yours would be, okay, then just sign them.
Yeah. Well, and then I think that, so if you take both of them, you look at the income tax one. The most interesting thing to me is the narrative was, well, we don't have an income tax, so we don't need this. And you shouldn't be spending your time on stopping an income tax when we could be doing much more important things like creating an income tax. Right? I mean, that was like almost every single one of them said, well, we have this regressive tax policy.
Yeah.
Why are you trying to stop an income tax when we really don't vote on it? But give us an income tax.
Right, they want an income tax. Yeah, There's no doubt. They say it all the time.
It's just blatantly there.
Right.
I don't know if they heard themselves on how sort of, yeah, you don't need that, but you don't need that protection because I'm going to take it away from you.
Yeah. So speaking of hurting themselves or helping themselves with this, so just yesterday, the Seattle Times published an op-ed from Democratic leaders saying we're going to sign the Parental Rights Initiative mm-hmm. into law. I think that's happening on Monday, or they're going to pass it. It seems pretty likely they're going to do that to all three. Do you agree?
I do. I heard from several people mm-hmm. there yesterday that would be in the know that they think the likelihood of them passing all three is very high.
What do you believe is the strategy there? Because I can't imagine they enjoy doing it, but they've decided that they must. Why do you think that is?
I think number one is the popularity of these three is so high that I think they've switched from a legislative strategy to an electoral strategy.
100%.
So I think there's a couple of things. Number one is you saw the sign in the police pursuit one was 96% for, like 3% against in the people that signed in. Even the income tax was high and the parental notification was very high. And I suspect that they have districts that they were worried about this, a non-red wave year becoming, unfortunately for them, a red wave year kind of risk that they had if they vote against. And these three in particular, I think, were so popular that they saw that as a risk.
But I almost feel like it legitimizes all of the initiatives.
Completely.
Because you've been vilified by these very Democrats. Yeah. And even in their op-ed, the first paragraph was like multi-millionaire hedge fund manager,
MAGA,
which is their favorite, you know, thing. I don't even know if they, did they say MAGA?
No, yeah, MAGA? Okay. I've been tagged with MAGA.
But, you know, they've dismissed your initiatives from the very beginning before the hearings as being your efforts to buy policy, yet they're going to make three of them law.
Democrat approved.
Right?
I'm
going
to get some stamps with Democrat approved.
So if they call the other ones MAGA initiatives, you'd be like, well, why did you support the other ones, right?
Right? That's right.
Yeah.
Whatcom County Democrats just came out and said, oh, this 2081 is anti-trans, which clearly it is not if you've read the law. So they've out there saying, you know, don't vote on 2081. And then here's the Speaker of the House going, no, it's totally cool. We're good with it. Yeah. Democrat approved. Right?
Yeah, I love it.
I think it puts them in a conundrum. And one of the things that came out in the hearing, if you listened, is they were, you know, they were pointing their guns ready to shoot. Does this change this law? Does it change that law? And especially 5599, right? They want to, mm-hmm. and I just, when we crafted it, the intent was not to take on the LGBT community in any way whatsoever. It was not I get there's a lot of emotions in that, and there's a lot of difficult decisions that people have to make. I was much more concerned on that one in particular with the secrecy. As I didn't get a chance, there were some shenanigans in that hearing, and I didn't get to testify. But my point would have been, if they were holding a secret Bible study class and secretly baptizing kids at school, parents would be legitimately mad. It's not the content.
Yep.
It's the secrecy that, to me, is a very terrible thing.
Yeah.
And further, if your child is talking about suicide at school, or tries to commit suicide, or has an abortion, or any of these life-changing things, and then your child comes home and the school doesn't tell you anything about it, and you've got this child in your home, and they're hurting, and they need help, and they need someone to put their arm around them, or love them like a parent. Sorry, I mean, need them emotional. Okay. Love them like a parent does, and I sort of put myself in that position. The kid is just suffering, and some bureaucrat at the school is making a decision that the parent needs to be left out of it.
Yeah.
And then if that child does something more horrific and takes their life, for example, that parent's got a lifetime of guilt, and they never knew. And that is so wrong. I don't know how anyone can support it. So when you get into the meat of the initiative, and this is, it's pro-parent, not anti-anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that when they got into it, as they were doing the hearing and you could hear them asking questions, they're really trying to gun for, well, you're trying to hurt trans kids. No, I'm not. I think they need love and they need the parent support more than anything. And it wasn't about trans kids to begin with. It was about parents being able to love and take care of their kids.
Look at this greedy multimillionaire trying to buy policy to line his pocketbook. Yeah. Scrooge. No. And it's true. It's this assumption of the worst in parents.
Yes.
It's really unfortunate.
Right.
And it's like, oh, we can do better than you can as a parent. That's ridiculous. Let's end with this, Brian. What does the fight look like between now and November?
Well, they've clearly chosen three that are backed by big money. Mm-hmm. And the SEIU, the long-term care mandatory payroll tax is just a gift to the SEIU. Everything about it was designed to help the SEIU and sort of screw anyone that gets the non-insurance. So there's going to be, they've already dropped money. They've already, like, there's a couple of million that are either pledged or in the coffers to fight that. And then the Climate Commitment Act that does nothing for the climate has huge money, right? There's, and my big concern about it, sorry, I know this isn't quite the question you asked, but my concern about it is the CCA is being used to fund Jay Inslee and his friend's retirement program.
Hmm.
It's a place where they're going to go and get a job and get a lobby job, right? And then they'll use all that money to come and fight against this idea. So I think there's a battle that's going to heat up there.
Yeah.
But I believe that the important sort of fight back, what happens in Washington State is about a 5-year harbinger of what's going to go on in the rest of the United States. Hmm. Look at all the abortion.
True.
I mean, abortion was codified here before almost any other state. Gay marriage, marijuana, sex offender registry, 3 strikes and you're out. These things originated primarily in Washington State and then sort of went to the rest of the nation. And I think what's happening right now is this sort of populist pushback against really radical progressivism.
Yeah.
And in particular, the Climate Commitment Act, which is a super huge tax on people. Your segment the other day on what's happening to schools. Mm-hmm. When you're taking $70,000 from a school district, and then you complain that there's not enough school funding. Well, you've got this regressive tax that hits the school and the person that's taking the kid to school. I think there's some national and even international implications on this one.
Yeah.
And so we'll be under the spotlight from a national point of view. We're going to fight back in the way that, the American Revolutionary Army fought against the British, right? We're outnumbered, we're outgunned, yeah. But we're going to figure out sneaky ways in the forest to push back and right will prevail.
Yeah, and we can't, no relenting.
Yes.
No relenting.
Yeah, no,
it's going to be a long, exhaustive fight. What can people do to help?
I think there's a couple of things. It's not over yet for the other three, right? They mm-hmm. should hold hearings.
They're not going to.
They won't, but yes, I agree. But I didn't think they would hold the first three hearings,
yeah.
Right? So I think people can still write into their legislatures and say, hold a hearing on these.
But the session's over on Friday.
They can still do stuff.
Okay.
Unlikely. I admit that.
A special session.
I'm a clear-eyed, yes. Doughy-eyed optimist,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things they can do. The second thing that they can do is talk with their neighbors, right, and raise an awareness. Because I think if Washingtonians know about this, they will support the three that are going to be on the ballot in mm-hmm. November. And the third thing, I just put up a bunch of cash, and I hate worse than anything asking anyone for money, but I think if you're invested in this, you'll do more. Yeah. And I would encourage people to go to Let's Go WA and support us. First, before you do that, you got to go to Undivided and subscribe to the podcast, right? I'll make that clear.
Thanks, Ryan.
I'm gonna because that's where you're going to get the really interesting news.
Yeah.
But after that, you know, support us and get your friends to support us. We need a broad coalition of people, both financially and physically, out there making noise. And come join us. Join me in the fight. So it's not just one guy fighting, and it takes away their narrative that I'm. They want to make me as this guy that's trying to buy the election. But I would encourage anyone that says that, go try to get someone to write their name, sign their signature, put yes. their birth date and their address down for something that they don't believe in.
Yeah. And on not one, but six of them.
On six.
Having volunteered to collect signatures, every single person was a task to get them to stay
to do one.
And sign every single one.
Right.
But you're right. You can't and you shouldn't have to do this alone financially. And the other side has an endless war chest. It is endless. They're going to use it to lie so much. We already see that happening. So if we want this to happen, we have to help push back. And you've already done so much. Also, with your reputation intact. I don't know. I'm surprised.
So far, we've
the
been...
amount of my former colleagues at Fox 13, Hannah Kim, did a wonderful yes. story on you. I yes. thought it was very fair. And as much as they've tried to paint you as like the rich Tim Iman, it hasn't stuck. And I think that's good. Now, nothing against Tim, but you're not Tim Iman. But there's a reason they tried to do that. And it's been interesting to watch them swing and miss on that, because you're obviously just, and I've said this on Twitter, it sounds very like I'm ingratiating myself. I don't think I need to ingratiate myself to you. But I've genuinely come to like you and to respect what you're doing. And Nicole and I, we both love when you stop by, because you're a really great, normal person. And I'm glad that other people are getting to see that as well, because the lies about you are rich, but you're not evil.
I'm not as rich as I was.
Yes. Yeah.
So well, it might be the manure sheen from my,
you kind of smell like gum, honestly.
That's right. I'm just kidding. That's right.
anyway. Okay.
Well, thank
I said
so
all those
much.
Nice things because you told people to subscribe to my podcast.
Well,
so.
Now we're even. So.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Well,
thank
Brian
you.
Haywood, we look forward to just keeping in the fight with you.
We appreciate it, and we appreciate all your listeners who showed up on the Capitol steps and went out and collected signatures. And this doesn't get done by one person. This is a whole state that rises up and does something different.
Yeah, as much as Democrats want to act like this is the work of one person, so many people have contributed with these initiatives, getting to the point where they're at, getting hearings, hopefully those three of them being signed into law, and then we got to turn our focus to what will be the bigger, more difficult fight on the three initiatives that involved an awful lot of money that Democrats are getting in, and they're not going to give that money up without a fight. So we've got to stay in the fight, and we'll be talking, I'm sure, in the months to come about opportunities for all of you to continue to be involved in that process. All right, I have been encouraging you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. Man, if you are, especially if your budget's stretched thin right now, or you're just overwhelmed with things to do, let First Mark Insurance handle all of your insurance needs. Mike and I love it. We've been members of the First Mark family for a year. It's a local company, no crazy phone trees when you have to file a claim. The First Mark Challenge, what it involves is you're going to schedule some time on the phone or Zoom with First Mark Insurance. You're going to go over your current insurance and talk to them about your insurance needs. Maybe you don't even know whether your insurance is good enough, whether it covers what you need it to cover. Maybe you have insurance that you don't even need that you're paying for. They're going to talk to you about that, your budget. They're going to go out, shop the market for you, bring you back a proposal, and then you can decide whether you want to become a member of the First Mark family and have them handle your insurance needs. By the way, they do it for free. It doesn't cost you a dime. Here's Dave Taylor. He's the CEO of First Mark.
I really want to encourage folks, don't try to navigate this current market by yourself. I believe you need to get with a broker. Okay, obviously I'd love them to come to First Mark, but at a minimum they need to be with a broker that works with numerous carriers that can give them the advice they need and really help them navigate this right now, because it's complicated.
Yeah, especially if you've got to file a claim. And sometimes these big carriers right now, given the state of things with crime, et cetera, they're just dropping people left and right. So if you don't have an insurance broker like First Mark on your side, a local person who's going to pick up the phone and walk you through that, that's a very difficult, time-intensive process to try to get new insurance. So take the First Mark Challenge today. You just got to set aside an hour of your time. It's going to pay dividends on the back end. FirstMarkInsurance.com, FirstMarkInsurance.com. They work for you, not the insurance companies. All right, the infamous sign stealer, the is she former yet? No. The on leave North Kitsap school superintendent who was charged with stealing signs for a school bond that were signs that were opposed to the school bond that she supported is getting off the hook basically scot-free. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. Oh, good day in court for North Kitsap School Superintendent Dr. Lauren Evans, who, as you know by now, was caught on a game camera yanking political yard signs that she disagreed with out of the ground and hawking them into the woods. She had done this on more than one occasion, so much so that two citizens got together, they did a stakeout, they set up game cameras, they followed her truck, they handed all the evidence over to police, and what did Lauren Evans say? I'm being set up. This was a setup. That's not me. Totally denied it. Police and prosecutors disagreed. She ended up being charged. Well, now she is going to get off scot-free with just a little bit of pretrial diversion. This is from the Kitsap Sun. NK superintendent will pay restitution, avoid prosecution in sign case. So she is going to have to pay $332. To the owner of the sign, which we had on the show, that she allegedly removed. And she is going to have a six-month probationary period where she cannot break the law during that 6 months. And if she does, the district court judge in Kitsap County said that if she violates the agreement, the judge will decide solely based on probable cause documents whether she's guilty of the charge she faces. And he warned her, according to King 5, that in that event, she would likely be convicted. Judge Jeffrey Jans said, "This is a serious charge," he told Evans. "It involves, allegedly, election interference by a public official. If you violate this agreement, it is likely you will serve some jail time." According to King 5's, Dr. Evans' defense attorney said it was in the best interest of his client, the school district, and parents and students of North Kitsap to put the incident behind them. I tend to think that there are some parents who firmly disagree with the notion that it's in their best interest that she get pretrial diversion and her only punishment is a $332 sign. It still amazes me that this story wasn't bigger. I mean, the media has covered it, right? But you're talking about a school superintendent who stole political yard signs specifically against a school bond that she supported. And all the crazy ins and outs of this story with her being chased down by citizens to document their own evidence in this case, it's just interesting, you know, that this wasn't wall to wall.
Well, I mean,
I'm disappointed with the diversion, not surprised.
I know that legally it looks a certain way, but I mean, this should still take her out of her position.
Well,
right?
that's the question now is she fired? There's no way she can go back.
It's admitting guilt, right? I mean, you're on your record doesn't look, or you know, it's not going to look as bad, but you're admitting you did something wrong.
Well, it's clear she did. So even if you're not convicted, the preponderance of the evidence is clear.
Right.
And there's no way you can go back to being the school superintendent. And at this time where it's like, oh, democracy is at peril, you have a bona fide example of not some random person, a public official trying to interfere with an election. The bond failed, by the way, which I think is good comeuppance for her. But this is one of those things where I feel like you do need to set an example. You know, there's some people on the right who are like, oh, election interference. And I think they cry wolf a lot and just completely manufacture stuff. But then there are cases that are totally legit.
Clear.
And you're like, ah, give them diversion. No, you throw the book. We should be throwing the book at anyone who genuinely interferes with an election, commits election fraud, etc. And the fact that these things are treated with kid gloves, I think, just gives fuel to the right when they say we don't believe there is election interference. We don't trust the elections. Just like with the Democrats and their snitch line on signature gatherers, etc. With that being downplayed, and you don't even have the Secretary of State's office coming out and speaking out against his own party doing that and pushing these snitch lines and harassing signature gatherers. Now, his office did support a bill to try to protect signature gatherers, which failed this legislative session. So it's just interesting. It's like, you want to say democracy's in peril and that the right is completely crazy when they say election interference, but then when there's interference in the election by Democrats, it's like, oh, no big deal. Just sweep it under the rug. Meanwhile, we're going to talk about this story next week. There's this thing called Logically AI that the Secretary of State's office, it's a no-bid contract where they're monitoring possible election interference claims on the internet. I am consistently swept up in this Logically AI thing. Wow. Some people have got their hands on these reports that are sent back to the state from Logically AI. You know what they've flagged me for as like a potential something that could feed narratives about election interference? Segments I did on this.
Right.
Literally stating a truth that the a superintendent was stealing yard signs.
On the news?
I'm the one who's flagged by AI. Mm-hmm. And then pointing out that Democrats are running these initiative snitch lines, which they did publicly and they were proud of. I'm the one who's flagged by this Logically AI. Isn't that crazy?
It's pretty insane.
It is insane. And so I really have half a mind to write to the Secretary of State again and say, look, is this the intention of this AI effort? Like, if you're going to try to find real election risks, wouldn't it be the Democratic Party that's flagged for doing that? Wouldn't it be this doctor?
These people and anybody that supports these people. So if somebody's out there voicing support for the snitch lines, if somebody's out there supporting this superintendent, those people should be flagged.
Why are you flagging me for pointing it out?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the Logically AI thing needs, that contract needs to end. It's not, and it's also not a contract that's designed to help, you know, strengthen trust in elections. It's doing the opposite. When you flag me for pointing out genuine acts of election interference as me being the problem, that contract needs to end sure.
Hobbs has got to come on.
Hobbs has to come on. Hobbs, we need to talk to you. We have things to discuss. Nicole, reach out.
Again.
Look. I think he's more reasonable than most Democrats.
Oh, I do. I agree. I just don't, that's why I don't see why he won't. I think before the election, better be
taking my frustration out of the keyboard today. Daryl's going to call and be like, can you stop ruining your computer? All right, before we get to a little bit of national news and Florida report, our friend Wes Jones is advising that if you're thinking about selling your home at any point this year, it's really important to get a head start, especially if you need some cosmetic updates before it hits the market to make sure you get top dollar. Wes and his team, you know, he's waiting for obviously the Fed to drop interest rates, which is going to be a good sort of rush to the housing market that it desperately needs. But he said, in the meantime, while you're waiting for that, give him a call and you can get started on the process of listing your home.
You know, I've turned houses around in a week or two, that were ready. Mm-hmm. And then there's been others that have really taken 6 to 12 months. But, we have a pretty extensive process. There's a lot of work that we do on the front end. Call me as soon as you're thinking about it. No obligation. I think knowledge is power. So the earlier that you can learn, the better off that you're going to be. And if you decide that it's a fit, then we have more time to prep the house and it's a little less stressful.
Yeah, a couple things he's going to do for you. He's going to start by giving you a free market analysis, let you know how well your home is positioned, depending on the neighborhood you live in, market conditions, et cetera. And then he's going to talk to you about their Listing Boost concierge service. If you need some updates to your home, they can manage those projects entirely. They can even help you pay for it up front, which I think is a really stress-free way of doing it. You can also start by using their home value calculator on the website, sellwithwest.com, just to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwest.com, a better way to sell your home. I want to play a quick clip that's been going around from the mayor of Athens, Georgia. So you might recall that Laken Riley, a student at UGA, was murdered while out for a run by an illegal immigrant who had come in across the border illegally in 2022 and then just was released into the country, went up to New York City because they didn't have detention space for him, was accused of committing a crime in New York City, and then ends up allegedly murdering Laken Riley. Well, the Democratic mayor of Athens, he is not happy with this narrative that illegal immigrants are dangerous. And he got shouted down at a press conference by citizens who were livid with him.
That term means different things to different people depending on the context of the discussion. Many of the elements.
Liar.
We are here to listen.
You're a liar.
We are here to listen. There'll be time for questions.
You are guilty and got blood on your head for this murder, sir.
Many of the aspects that are ascribed to sanctuary cities.
We know what sanctuary
are things that are disallowed by Georgia law. And we contribute a document every year to the Georgia Department of Audits, indicating that we do not correspond to these definitions under state law.
Yes, you do.
And no policies have been adopted by the mayor and commission that have created sanctuary city status in Athens.
You need to resign.
One protocol that sometimes arises.
Resign now.
You allow this to happen. leaving, sir.
Dang. I love that he's like, you're here to listen. Don't tell me what I'm here for. I'm a citizen. You're an elected leader. But he'd also said that he doesn't see this correlation. He thinks it's dangerous between illegal immigration and crime. Even if he believes that, the dumbest thing to say when you're dealing with an outraged community because a young girl was murdered in cold blood by an illegal immigrant. So for you to go and try to downplay that and downplay that concern of having someone who came here from another country, we don't know what their baggage was coming into the country. We don't know what their criminal history was in the country that they came from, coming here illegally, being released into the interior of the country, being accused of a crime in New York, and then murdering an innocent college kid. And your response as a mayor is to downplay the correlation between the danger of our immigration crisis and crime like murder when we've had so many instances. And then there was this other, gosh, I wasn't even going to talk about this. Let me just see if I can find it really, really quick on my feed. It was this terrible, oh God, no, that's not it. It was this terrible article about this Athens. Oh, here it is. Oh my gosh. This is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. This is a real to swear to God headline in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Quote, not fair. After UGA killing, Venezuelans in Georgia worry about the backlash. Are you kidding me? So, look, I agree not every Venezuelan should be vilified because an illegal Venezuelan immigrant killed a girl. But they're honest to God after this girl's death, using a quote from them saying, not fair, as opposed to talking about the real public safety concerns and the pain that this community is going through and the family of Lake and Riley. But Democrats irreparably broken, the media irreparably broken. Crazy, 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 red-pilled even more every day. All right, let's take a break from my nonsense and check in, or Washington's nonsense, and check in on what's happening in Florida, particularly the very different ways that Washington State and Florida are handling the rise in anti-Semitism. It's our weekly segment, Florida Report.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Miranda, hello.
Hello.
You've kind of got, I had a Cruella DeVille style dress on the other day, and you're sort of rolling with the same vibe.
I am. I actually saw that dress and I'm like, oh, I like that.
Yes. Good. Would be good for a costume. So if I don't have one in October, I'll rely on that. Okay. So a bill related to kind of Jeffrey Epstein is what brought it about. Ron DeSantis has signed a bill that would allow the disclosure of what would be secret grand jury testimony only in certain instances.
Yeah, it would be in instances where the suspect or the defendant in the case is deceased, and also there is accusations of sexual misconduct towards minors, which the Epstein case falls right underneath those parameters. So I'm sure that this bill has a lot to do with that case in particular, and it'll be interesting to see what other cases maybe apply to this that we don't even know about. It's in an effort to just provide a little bit of information and stuff to the public and to the victims in these cases. What was her name? Maxine?
Yep.
Was that what? Yeah, she's Maxwell. Maxwell. She's actually in prison in Florida. DeSantis made this announcement standing by two of the victims and defendants in the case of Epstein, just talking about how, you know, given the magnitude of this case, how nothing's come out about it, nothing's been said or done about it is pretty unreasonable. So he fully backs this bill, and I guess we'll see what comes from it.
Yeah. And the other, so it was, you mentioned two of the requirements for HB 117 to kick in. The other one was the testimony was previously disclosed by a court order and the state attorney is notified. And, you know, I think had the initial Epstein investigation in Florida been handled differently, you know, history would have been so different. And you obviously wouldn't have gone on to victimize so many people. And it's always sort of bugged me that grand jury testimony is this secretive thing. I understand there's some reasons for that. But in cases like this, like you said, the guy's dead. It involves egregious potential sex crimes against minors that might be disclosed and the people who were involved in it. Yeah. Let us know if you have the power to do that. Okay. So Florida has also, in Washington State, we just killed a bill that would have improved Holocaust education in our schools. So it gives you an example of how different our two states are. In Florida, a bill was just passed that defines anti-Semitism. So how does it define it?
So the language was taken from the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and I'm just going to read it so it's quoted properly. It defines anti-Semitism as a certain perception of Jewish individuals, with which may be expressed as hatred towards such individuals. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of anti-Semitism are directed towards Jewish and non-Jewish individuals and their property, or towards the Jewish community, institutions, and religious facilities. This is, I think, just like, by defining it, it not only makes a statement that this is something we're not just not going to tolerate, but it also gives police officers and other authorities the ability to identify and prosecute people for being anti-Semitic in certain ways.
Well, and there's also been all this sort of disagreement between, oh, is this pro-Palestine or is it anti-Semitism? And where is the line there? And there is a difference, I think, but a lot of people are blurring the two things. So defining it and saying, did you do this, I think is a really good thing. And then there's not this conjecture about, oh, were they just defending, you know, people in Gaza, or were they being anti-Semitic? One final story, man, I don't know if I'd ever venture outside if I lived in Florida. I feel like, what, is there a 99% chance that you'll be attacked by a crocodile if you live in Florida?
There's a 99% chance you'll be attacked by something, whether it's UV rays or a crocodile, that's on you. But yeah, so there's a lot of the communities in Florida, people get around by golf cart. That's just part of the Florida lifestyle. But you are subject to being attacked by crocodiles or alligators, as these people found out. And they were just casually driving through a community in Florida. And this crocodile literally chased the golf cart down. Like, it didn't, I don't even think they provoked this poor creature, but it felt provoked enough to chase down a couple people in a golf cart.
Yeah, Florida, better politicians, better tax policy, gosh, better issues, better crime. You say better crime, better public safety, but you might get attacked by a crocodile. So that's like the trade-off if you leave Washington for Florida. All right, Miranda, we appreciate it.
Bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Still worth it to me. I'd rather get chased down by a crocodile than deal with some of this absolute nonsense that we're dealing with in Washington State. I'm going to Florida. I need you guys, between you and I, Nicole knows this, I need a vacation. Oh my gosh. My brain is, it's weird because, you know, you have some jobs that are kind of like physical labor and then some jobs that are exhausting for other reasons. Maybe you have a lot of travel or whatever it is. This is like the amount of brain capacity to like do this show every day has left me so exhausted. Does that sound whiny?
No, not whiny, but a lot of, I mean, yes, it's hard work.
It's
and you
just,
you deserve a vacation here and there.
I'm not done. I'm just getting started. However,
I'm sure that people already know this, but Brandy's a workaholic. She's a live to work type of person.
That's all right. We're not working. We're changing things.
I know. It's important.
Making a difference.
And we're very blessed. You guys let us do it.
Oh my God. We get to do a podcast for a living. That's awesome. But yeah, I need a vacation. So I'm going to go to Florida like in
end of April.
We won't cancel any shows, I don't think. Maybe I should say that in advance.
We're adjusting.
We're doing some specials that week.
There we go.
I think the end of, when am I going? End of May?
It's actually my birthday weekend or work.
Oh my God,
birthday
I'm
week.
Sorry.
No, it's perfect because I'm going on vacation.
Anyway, I am like mentally fraud. I've been complaining to Nicole every day. I just need a break. I need a break. I love being here and I don't have a break for a couple months, but I'm going to go to Florida and get chased by, is it alligators or crocodiles?
That's an alligator.
Alligator, sorry. Can I keep saying they're different? Yep. Anyway, okay. Before we get to questions and comments and our daily subscriber show poll, we have Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital on every week. And I thought, given a story we talked about yesterday, that I, this week, would tell Zach what a strong economy looks like for a change. So here's Zach Abraham and me imparting my wisdom about the strength of the economy onto him. Zach Abraham, welcome back to Undivided.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always fun.
Yeah, you know a good indicator of a strong economy?
No, but I know you're going to tell me.
Yes, when the CEO of Kellogg goes on CNBC and tells people if they can't afford dinner for their family just to eat cereal.
The cereal category has always been quite affordable, and it tends to be a great destination when consumers are under pressure. So some of the things that we're doing is first messaging. We got to reach the consumer where they are. So we're advertising about cereal for dinner. If you think about the cost of cereal for a family versus what they might otherwise do, that's going to be much more affordable.
I mean, things are cranking. I'm proud to be an American. We're at the top of our game, Brandy. You know, it kind of reminds me of the Bernie Sanders deal, right? People think bread lines are bad. I think bread lines are great. And you're kind of like, boy, doesn't that sound like part and parcel? You know, it's kind of the same side, you know?
Well, it's like when gas got too expensive, Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, is like, well, just buy an electric car. It's
like, oh. Yeah, and now if you're in California, they're telling you not to charge it, right?
Yeah, buckets of wisdom from these people.
Yeah, this all goes back to, there's a bigger issue here. And I think you and I have talked about this before on the show. If I look at the world through the lens of the data that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and the U.S. government are putting out, it just doesn't square, right? We've talked about it. Like, you talk to business owners, you talk to regular consumers, and you tell them, you know, you talk about this whole strong economy narrative. Do you feel it? Nobody does. Everybody's telling you, but man, what's going on? Well, when you understand how they calculate inflation and economic growth, if they're understating inflation, which to me it looks like they are, meaning if the inflation rate's really like 5 to 5.5 or even 6, a lot more of this economic data makes a lot of sense, right? Because I don't think that we're plunging. I don't think we're in a recession. But, you know, 4.5% growth is what they're saying that we're at. Like, think back to 98, 99, 2005, 2006. Economy's going great guns, people making money. That's what that looks like. Okay, this ain't it. And when you see people changing what they're eating, and Kellogg's is making more money because they, or Kroger or whatever it is, they're making more money because people can only afford. I mean, come on, right? Wait, what are we talking about here? So I think it's a product of goal seeking for data, meaning the Federal Reserve has been adjusting down inflationary metrics for 40 years. Some of it for good reason, some of it not. But now I think you're at a position where, much like the unemployment rate, when you understand how the unemployment rate is calculated, if the unemployment rate doesn't stay changed, so if no new workers come into the system and no new workers leave the system for a long enough time, the unemployment rate will go to zero, even though nothing has changed, right? I think they've kind of done the same thing with inflation, where it's not completely bogus, but it's not telling you the story that they're saying it is.
Yeah, I mean, don't believe anyone who's going to tell you the economy is doing well when the CEO of Kellogg is suggesting Americans buy cereal for their kids for dinner if they can't afford real food. So that's just like, it doesn't take Zach Abraham to let me know that that's probably not a sign of a good economy. By the way, I asked Zach, Nicole, if even Zach Abraham had to buy cereal for dinner, what it would be. And he said Cheerios.
Honey Nut Cheerios.
Well, yeah.
That's better.
Yeah, not the plain kind. That's nasty. Honey Nut Cheerios with some ice cold milk. Anyway, yeah. With election looming, global unrest, rising cost of living, all this nonsense, like buy cereal for dinner. It's really important to make sure that you're protecting your retirement portfolio. Do you have someone managing it who's going to appropriately manage your risk? I suggest having a free Know Your Risk portfolio review with Zach Abraham and his team at Boar Capital. This is what they do. This is what they specialize in, managing your risk to make sure that you're not putting your hard-earned retirement in peril. Their risk portfolio review, it's just a great way to see if you're overexposed to risk and then to take actions to mitigate it if you are. So schedule your free risk review now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. I wonder what you guys would choose for your cereal. I mean, honestly, though, some Honey Nut Cheerios, mm-hmm. I was telling Zach, ice cold milk, and then some banana pieces. Oh, that actually sounds delish.
It really does. That's
I want to eat it because I want it, not because I can't afford real food.
Right.
You know?
Right. No, definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, my favorite was, I like when it gets a little bit soggy, the corn pops. Corn pops, a little soggy.
No sogginess in the cereal. Anyway, our daily subscriber show poll, I asked you guys about the debate we were having at the beginning of the show. Do you believe a parent using fentanyl in the home should by itself be enough for the state to temporarily remove the child? Most of you are saying yes, although there is a little dissent. And like I said, I think reasonable people can disagree on sort of burden of proof. And obviously, this was a comment I got a lot. Like, what if you're prescribed fentanyl or something like that? There's a big difference between a medical professional and fentanyl as a necessity that's legal and what we're talking about here. And I believe the bill does make sure that there is daylight between the two of those things. Y says, I hear fentanyl can be absorbed through skin, and even a tiny speck smaller than a sesame seed can be fatal to a grown man. I cannot understand how anyone can think having that substance around kids are not of immediate concern. It's because of ideology. Oh, drug users? These are the same people who are trying to convince us that fentanyl and meth being detected on all of our public transit is totally no problem at all, and that somebody smoking meth or fentanyl around a bus driver shouldn't be of a concern to that bus driver. It doesn't make sense at all, and common sense tells us that's ridiculous. The same with this. Dana Baker says, as far as the child dying from fentanyl-laced marijuana, which was something brought up by one of the lawmakers, that would have to be marijuana bought illegally off the street. The parents are already making bad choices around their kids. I agree. Rob says, what if it's, again, prescribed medication, so that's different. Julie says, it's hard to believe that this is even a debatable topic. And like Democrats argued last year with 5599, where they're trying to protect kids from their gay-hating parents or whatever it is, no burden of proof to prove that the parent has done anything wrong to the child, but we can keep them safe just in case. Just in case. Wouldn't you rather us keep them safe than your child die in a hate crime or something like that? I mean, this is wild stuff. And then this year they're like, oh, fentanyl around the kid? No, we need a high, high burden of proof for that. That's some crazy stuff. That's truly insane. Let's see here. Rachel Cisnero says, Brandy, please invite some of these Democrats on your show who show this kind of hypocrisy and drill them. I think we should invite Tana Sen. Nicole, get on that, because I would like to truly understand where she's coming from with that.
We have a open invitation.
Open it. Well, I think we should reach out to Tana Sen specifically. Jory Freeman, the state failed me as a child, removed from an abusive and drug addicted parent multiple times, placed into foster homes where the drug use was just as prevalent as the home I was removed from. This continued several times until I aged out of the system. I mean, that's absolutely horrifying. Let me see. Mark says, sadly, Tana Sen is my representative. She frequently runs unopposed. You should still send her an email, though, and say, ask her. Because she'll respond to you. Ask her to explain the hypocrisy between her remarks on 5599 and her remarks on fentanyl. I would also note that using drugs or exposing your child to drugs is illegal, right? If your child is actually exposed to them. But there's no law on the books that says it's illegal not to support your child's desired gender. So they're putting a lower burden of proof on something that's actually illegal than they are something that just ideologically they don't agree with. That's crazy stuff. On Brian Haywood's interview, Miss Jennifer says, so thankful for Brian. What a leader. Yeah, I mean, it's really cool to see what's happening in our state right now. A lot of momentum. Let me see. Glenn Ripley, on my assertion that the Washington Democrats are irreparably broken, he says, seems the R party is broken in that factions don't support each other and seem to require purity. Doesn't bode well for them winning elections if they can't learn to have each other's backs. I agree. Mm-hmm. Disaster. I mean, you look at the semi-bird Dave Reichert sort of camps. How many vicious emails do we get any time I say that I support Dave Reichert?
Oh,
a ton. It's lots. Unhinged. It's very similar to what I endured with Lauren Culp and his crazy attacks. And that's, I don't see Dave Reichert out there vilifying and attacking people who support Semi Bird over him. You don't see it at all. It's childish. It's a level of, what is the word I'm looking for? Entitlement. Mm-hmm. Because I don't support someone you support, that I have to be attacked and vilified by a party that I have been very favorable to. It's really ridiculous stuff.
It's really, it's quite unhinged. I mean, every weekend, it's crazy.
Oh, it is.
Just for, you know, it's not like we've said anything terrible.
Well, and also, you can support who you want to support. I don't care if you support Semi Bird.
It's
my opinion,
your vote,
that he can't win and that Dave Reichert is leaps and bounds more qualified and doesn't have the long list of baggage that Semi Bird has. You lied about a court martial. If a Democrat had lied about a court martial, you really think you'd be defending that Democrat? Of course not. Come on, that's common sense. Let's be reasonable. All right, let's get into our closing sanity check.
And by the way, on Drug Street, he's our Sunday show this week.
Oh, we have an awesome Sunday show interview with a man named Tom Wolfe. So Tom Wolfe was leading a normal life in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. That's where he's from. Had a family, a house, a wife who loved him until he spiraled into substance abuse because he entered this, like a lot of people did, through prescriptions from their doctor, that they ran out of, and then they turned to heroin, and then he turned to fentanyl. He spent time homeless on the streets of San Francisco before he got an opportunity to turn his life around because he was arrested. He was in Seattle this week. He joined us in studio to share his remarkable story. You've got to hear it. And he's our guest this week on Sundays with Subscribers. Really cool. It is. And really with cool. that, let's get to our closing sanity check. My friend David Rose at Fox 13, he's had enough. All right, so David Rose, former host of Washington's Most Wanted, an anchor at Fox 13, you know, he's really into crime issues and all of this, but he sent out a tweet that I gotta say, I'm like, wow, this seems like an opinion from David that he usually wouldn't share publicly, but he said, "Dear God and voters, please stop the madness. I have run out of ways to explain why criminals are treated better than victims now." Amen. "Man accused of hitting and killing father with stolen truck in front of his young son has a lengthy record." And he shared this story. This is the Fox 13 story of a suspect who says that he was arrested last October for reckless driving and eluding an officer. Court documents say he drove toward officers in Berrien on October 18th, almost hit a woman and her dog. He crashed into the front driver's side of a patrol vehicle, an apartment complex dumpster, and wood fencing. Deputies say he continued to evade police, hitting multiple marked and unmarked police vehicles. When the wheels of the van went flat, he took off on foot. Officers arrested him and found a baggie of meth. He had two active warrants for his arrest. Fast forward, he's got a felony conviction for unlawful possession of a firearm, taking a motor vehicle without permission. He has seven misdemeanor convictions for vehicle prowl and one for violating a no-contact order. He's had 21 warrants for his arrest throughout his whole life. He has felony convictions in Texas. He is still not behind bars, and as a result, he hit and killed a father in front of his young son while driving a stolen vehicle. Here's the bottom line. Politicians in this state have created an environment of lawlessness. And it is innocent people right now who are living and dying by those policies. As David Rose said, "Dear God and voters, please stop the madness." That has been our sanity check for today, and that has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Don't miss our interview with Tom Wolf coming up on Sunday. You can become a subscriber for just $5 a month. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com. So we will see subscribers on Sunday. We will see the rest of you back on the live show tomorrow. And don't forget, we have another edition of Politics Unpacked that will hit your inboxes tomorrow morning.